Straight out of Scotland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Edinburgh. If you were listening to the last episode, you heard my conversation with Aku Vasala on the Imago Dei, cognitive science, and free will. In today's episode, we pick up the conversation on free will. We ask if free will is compatible with divine determinism and consider some different debates in theology between Martin Luther and Erasmus. We also look at some of the evidence from cognitive science about the role of belief and free will in our moral and social behavior. This episode also contains the ever-popular popcorn round. If you have questions or topics that you would like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here's Aku and I talking about free will. Enjoy. All right, so on the last episode, we were starting to talk about the relationship between freedom and if it's compatible with determinism. And so I want to get into some of those issues a bit more detail here. So I think it would be good if we just kind of start with a bit of a recap on free will. So you had told us in the last episode about free will light, free will regular, and free will premium. So just give us a quick reminder of what those three things are.
So this is a kind of shorthand, quick classification of various views on free will. And the idea is that If one has free will light, if the kind of conditions for free will according to these theories is that you act rationally without any internal or external compulsion. So you have no internal compulsions, external problems that then affect or somehow disabilitate your ability to act on the basis of reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's free will light. Free will regular is free will light plus the ability to do otherwise. Mm-hmm. So in addition to being able to act reasonably and rationally, according to these views, what you need is the ability to make kind of metaphysically robust choices between alternative possibilities. That's free will regular. And finally, there's free will premium. According to these views, even making these undetermined choices is not enough. What you need is the ability to make choices about the kind of person that you are. Mm-hmm. So you have to be in control of your character. You have to be able to somehow shape yourself. And that's the free will premium.
Okay, so I've got these three views here. Now, I want to get into this issue of if freedom is really compatible with being theologically determined, somehow being determined by God. So let's kind of lay a bit of this out here. What exactly does it mean to be determined by God? And then why would someone even believe in theological determinism?
Well, there are a number of reasons why views like divine determinism, let's just call this divine determinism, mm-hmm. have been quite popular. Traditionally, they have been a kind of almost a standard view, which is might be surprising for some contemporary people because we tend not to think in these ways.
Right.
But traditionally, in the Christian tradition and the philosophical tradition as a whole, people have tended towards this divine determinism. And the idea there is that because God is the source of everything, God is distinct from the world, and God has created the world from nothing. And the world stands in a very kind of unique relationship with God. God is something special, not a being inside the world, mm-hmm. but God is causing and upholding the world, conserving the world all the time. And even according to some traditional views, God is causing everything that happens in the world. Mm-hmm. God stands in a very specific causal relationship with the world. It follows from this that whatever happens in the world, it's not just an accident. So it's part of God's action in the world. So God has this kind of causal relationship with all bits in the world, which seems to make kind of plausible the view that God really necessitates or determines whatever happens. It might be God's will or God's knowledge or something like that that is actually doing the determining. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that the world can only go in one direction. It can just go the way that God has created it. So this is the core idea. And one of the reasons why one might accept something like this is just this idea of God being the creator, mm-hmm. or God being omnipotent. This is another reason. So because there's nothing really that can stop God doing from what God wants to do, mm-hmm. or because there's no greater thing in the world that can stand or resist God, God's will will eventually go through. So there's nothing that can stop God from doing what God wants. So that's, again, one reason to think that something like divine determinism is true. Then there's the issue of God's knowledge. Many people and most theists think that God has perfect knowledge. So God knows everything that has happened and will happen and so on. And one way one could take God to have this knowledge is that, well, God is causing it. God is God knows why these things happen and how they happen, because he's part in causing all of that.
Right.
And this, again, seems to fit in very well with the idea that God actually determines whatever happens. And especially during the Reformation, when there were a lot of debates about this, Martin Luther, Luther himself used this idea of God's omnipotence and God's knowledge as a basis for arguing for divine determinism. So he said that if God doesn't make any mistakes and God's will is unchangeable. So if God wants something, God wants it and full
stop.
And that's that. And because nothing can really stand in God's way and God has full power and full knowledge, whatever God wants, that happens. Mm-hmm. And this is spiritually beneficial and this is religiously good, because then we can trust. Then we can trust that if God promises something, then God will keep his promise. And so Luther saw it from a kind of religious and spiritual point of view, that it's that a God who keeps his promises, who always and whose good will is always done, is better than a God who might make a mistake or take risks or something like that.
Yeah.
So you want to have a God. This is why divine determinism is a good thing, religiously speaking,
right.
Because you want to have a God whose will cannot be thwarted, whose actions cannot be messed up by humans or anything else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to make sure I'm following along this, right? So if I'm already committed to saying God's the cause of everything that exists, and I think God's omnipotent, he's all powerful, there's this thing called the infallibility of omnipotence, that whatever an omnipotent being wills to happen, it's going to happen. It couldn't possibly go any other way, because otherwise, really not that powerful. And that's really cool, because now I know when God makes a promise, like, he's going to be able to keep it. Then I know that when God says things are going to turn out all right, well, they're definitely going to, because he's got this infallible omnipotence. So there might be these some extra added benefits to it as well, from like a spiritual perspective. Okay, so those are some reasons why someone might affirm divine determinism. So I want to get into this issue now about whether or not freedom is actually compatible with divine determinism. Do you think that's the case?
It depends on what kind of free will you want. So of the three views that we laid out, free will light, free will regular, free will premium, people have debated whether these different views are, to what extent they are compatible with divine determinism. Mm-hmm. And of course, traditionally, as I said, divine determinism has been quite popular. So people have thought that this is something that really follows from our view of God. And as a consequence, they've been pressed, or at least there's been some pressure, to adopt something like free will light. Because it's easy to see how free will light is compatible with divine determinism. Because all you need for free will light is something like the ability to act rationally and without any compulsion. Well, God's determining things is not really any kind of compulsion. Mm-hmm. So God is not forcing anyone to do anything. God's action in the world is not based on any kind of mental problems or external pressures. So God is not putting a gun to your head, or no, God is really interfering any way in kind of normal operations of your brain, things like that. So God doesn't seem to be introducing any kind of compulsion or that kind of necessity in the world, even if divine determinism is true. So it seems that free will light is kind of easily compatible with this. There might be problems with this, but this is something that I think it's fairly plausible. Then the next question is whether something like free will regular is compatible with divine determinism. And a number of people have said that some form of free will regular is actually compatible. This is because in order to make choices, the way that we talk about choices is not like there are two alternative possibilities that are available to us at the moment of choice. But when we talk about choices, is that the way that we talk about them is that if things had been different in the past, I would have made a different choice at a particular moment. So when I say that I had a choice about something, What I'm saying is that if I had had different sets of beliefs and intentions at that moment, I could have done otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And this way of understanding choice, this way of acting, being able to do otherwise, this is clearly compatible with determinism. Of course, and the question is whether this view of this way of understanding the way to the ability to do otherwise is enough.
Right.
But that's a different. That's a rather difficult.
Yeah.
A difficult philosophical debate, and there's a lot going on there. And a lot of people debate about that. But still, that's one way of making free will regular,
mm-hmm.
Compatible with the divine determinism. Also, I'm not sure about free will premium.
Mm-hmm.
There might be versions of free will premium that are compatible with divine determinism, kind of bare bones divine determinism. But the problem is that a lot of people who hold on to divine determinism, like many of the reformers, like Luther and others, they have auxiliary views. They have other views that really rule out free will premium. And one idea that's behind there is the notion of sin.
Oh, okay, right.
So many of the reformers have a very strong view of sin. And one way to understand that is to say, that what goes on with sin is that the kind of fundamental orientation and the fundamental moral motivation of human beings is somehow corrupted. And there's really nothing an individual or humans as a whole can do to change this fundamental kind of moral motivation,
mm-hmm.
that people have. And this, see, it seems to follow from this that there are aspects of our moral nature, aspects of our religious and spiritual natures that we can't really control. And this seems to rule out this idea of free will premium, that we can somehow control the kind of person that we are, that we can shape our moral character in a very specific sense. We can kind of make ourselves good people,
mm-hmm.
or we can make ourselves bad people, and we can be responsible for this overall moral direction of our lives. But if this strong view of sin is correct, or especially original sin, it seems to me that this contradicts this idea of free will premium. And then usually people with this strong view of sin, like in Luther's case, they also go for divine determinism.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So if I'm going to be committed to theological determinism, I've got three options here on free will of like what kind of story I'm going to tell. So if I go with free will light, like you said, it seems pretty straightforward. Theological determinists can say your freedom's compatible because freedom just involves you, you know, acting for reasons. No big deal. If I've got free will regular, where I've got the reasons, like I'm the source and I'm acting for reasons, plus my ability to do otherwise, they've got some kind of story they can tell there, which I know is going to be very surprising to a lot of people who are listening, because a lot of times in some of the debates online, people assume that there's no way you can have that. And that's just not what any story that incompatibles would ever tell. And I'm like, well, historically, lots of them told this kind of story.
That's right, yeah.
Whatever, you know. But when it comes to free will premium, though, you're saying it's maybe not necessarily anything within theological determinism or divine determinism itself that would rule that out, but the sort of theological systems as a whole that adopt divine determinism, there's something else within their theological system that's going to rule that out, like believing in original sin or total depravity or something like that. That's going to rule out free will premium. That's the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so those are the kind of stories someone might tell if they're committed to divine determinism. Now, I want to look at the other side of the debate here, though. So what are some reasons for thinking that human freedom is not compatible with divine determinism?
Well, you just flip what you said around, mm-hmm. and that provides right. you the answer. So one might think that in order to have free will, or what is more important almost, is to have to be able to be morally responsible for one's actions. What one needs is this robust ability to make choices. And if one doesn't have that, then it seems weird to blame or punish a person from acting a certain way if the person didn't really have a choice,
mm-hmm.
To do that. And this is an intuition, I think, which is driving a lot of these debates about incompatibility. So the idea is that we know that God holds human beings responsible, morally responsible for the actions that they do and their omissions. So God holds us responsible. So there has to be a ground for that. Well, if we don't have a choice, many people then say, well, we can't be held responsible. We can't be held responsible. So the fact that God holds us responsible then implies that we indeed do have a choice. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of other reasons why people might think that. One is that God prefers certain kinds of relationships or wants us to be certain kinds of beings. And one is to have some sort of autonomy or to be able to form various kinds of relationships of love and sacrifice, things like that. And some people think that in order for us to be autonomous in this way, we have to be somehow separate from God's determining influence, mm-hmm. so to speak. So we have to be able to make choices that are not determined by God, so that they're not really up to God. They're up to us to make those choices. And in order to stand in relationships of love or sacrifice, things like that, to be autonomous in a certain way, these are required. And because God wants that kind of beings that can be autonomous, loving, and so on, because God wants that, he has to create us in a certain way, and he has to then kind of withhold his influence, mm-hmm. so to speak, in order for us to be able to be the kinds of beings that we are in that sense. So here are a number of reasons why one might think that there's a significant incompatibility, and these are theological reasons for thinking that.
So is one of the intuitions here, so you mentioned sacrifice. I guess it would seem a bit odd if I said, I'm going to sacrifice myself for a loved one. And then it turns out, well, that decision was caused by something else or by someone else. It wasn't really me making that choice. And it looked like I was making that choice. I felt like I was making that choice, but really someone else was doing all the causal work there to make me do that choice. If that's the case, then my intuition is saying, well, I didn't really make a sacrifice. Somebody else sacrificed me.
Yeah.
And that feels kind of weird, feels kind of gross. And is that some of the kind of intuitions here for saying, freedom is just not compatible with divine determinism?
Yeah, that's one. And it seems that this act of making a certain kind of commitment of will, mm-hmm. Which is very typical in these kind of close relationships, and moral choices, moral relationships, is quite important for us. And we seem to associate that with being somehow undetermined mm-hmm. by something else. I'm not married, but you're married. So mm-hmm. so when one gets married, the priest asks, do you want to take this woman as your wife? And you're asked about your will and your intentions. And it would again somehow feel quite weird if you would say, oh yes, I do and I will, but the will is not really up to me, or this act is not really up to me. It's mm-hmm. so it represents the way that I am, yes, and I do want it, but it's part of God's plan,
right?
or something like that. It seems somehow wrong to do that. It seems like it's not really you who's doing it mm-hmm. or saying it.
Yeah, it's not exactly like a shotgun wedding, because there's not a shotgun in my back saying, like, you will walk down this aisle, but it's some kind of weird divine, like, hidden shotgun, like, making me do these things. And that feels kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so those are some reasons why someone might say, look, freedom, determinism, they're not compatible. So, but imagine someone says something like this, though. So imagine I reject the claim that human free will is compatible with divine determinism. But that doesn't automatically commit me to any particular existence of human free will, right? Because it seems like I could say something like this. I could say, well, look, divine determinism is true, so therefore there is no human free will. Or I could do something else. I could say there is human free will, so therefore there is no divine determinism. Like, those are some of my options. Now, is there any sort of precedent for this in the Christian tradition for like either of these views?
Yes, there are. And there are different ways to play this. One is to say that we know that God wants us to be beings of a certain kind. Mm-hmm. And this requires us to have something like free will premium or free will regular. And we are somehow very certain about this. Mm-hmm. Or we know we can be quite confident that this is the case. Well, we can use this then as a kind of pry bar to or a latch to then argue against divine determinism and say, well, if this is the case and we're really sure about that, then perhaps we're wrong about divine determinism. And perhaps then divine determinism is false. And there are all sorts of views about God that adopt this way of thinking, and usually they are classified under open theism, sometimes called open theism, according to which there are certain contingencies in the world that cannot be controlled by God or determined by God, and this means then that there are. The world could go in all sorts of different ways. God might know how it goes, but God doesn't exactly control all of it. And there are many, many different debates and views on how open theism might work. But this is one way to go. And as far as I can see, it's usually motivated by this idea of, let's say, you know, strong views on free will. And free will has a very kind of specific and important role to play in these debates about what God's like. Because many people are convinced that, you know, free will premium, free will regular are not just, they're not compatible with God being determining everything. So that forces us to change our view of God. But you could also go the other way and say, well, because we know that the divine determinism is true, and we also have an idea that free will actually requires something like free will regular or even free will premium, well, too bad. That just means that we don't have free will.
Sure.
And this is actually something that some theologians have said. Again, I come back to Martin Luther, whom I mentioned before. And it seems that Luther tends to think this way. So he said that he seems to think that in order for us to have free will, we have to have the ability to do otherwise, and not only that, but we have to have the ability to make ourselves better, to make ourselves morally better. This is what free will is. But unfortunately, we don't have that, because we are sinful human beings, and God determines everything, so we have no choice, and there's nothing we can do to change our moral nature. And the way that Luther spins it is that he says that we know that there's nothing we can do to deserve anything from God, you know, good treatment from God. So we can't earn grace. And because we know this, we also know that we don't have free will. Because if we actually had free will, we could do something that would be good in the eyes of God. But we know that we can't, so there's no free will.
There just isn't any.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, there's really no free will at all. The way to go forward is to, here in a case like this, is adopt a view that contemporary philosophers have a complicated name for. People didn't have a name for this view during the Reformation
sure,
time.
Sure, yeah.
But nowadays they call this view semi-compatibilism.
Okay.
So the idea there is that that free will is not compatible with determinism. So if determinism is true, we can't have free will. But what is compatible with determinism is some form of moral responsibility. So, and this is a bit surprising, because normally, and the way that I tend to think about this, and many other people tend to think about this, is that free will is a necessary condition for moral responsibility.
Right, yeah.
In order to be morally responsible for one's actions, one needs to somehow control one's actions. So, and this is usually what free will is understood to be, kind of control condition for moral responsibility. But the semi-compatibilist is going to say, well, perhaps in order to have free will, we need something like free will regular. But that doesn't matter too much, because moral responsibility, for that, free will light is enough. So something like rational action and without any compulsion, that grounds moral responsibility. And we can be agnostic about whether we have free will, or we can even deny free will. And this is probably what Luther thought. So Luther still thinks that, well, we don't have free will, but God and is still God still has rights to hold us responsible for what we do, regardless of our lack of free will.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. So Luther's going to say divine determinism, that's true. So human free will, no such thing. You don't have it. I mean, if you did have it, you know, here's how that story would go, but you don't have it, so sorry, out of luck. But you're still morally responsible. which is, and that's quite surprising because a lot of us want to say free will is what you need for moral responsibility. But Luther's going to say you can have moral responsibility without free will.
Yeah.
And you are morally responsible. We know this because God holds you to be morally responsible.
Yeah,
he's going to condemn you or, you know, reward you based on your actions.
Yeah.
Okay, even though they're not free actions.
Yeah, so one way to make this work, again, Luther doesn't develop this very well.
Sure.
But
he's got a lot of stuff on his mind at that point. Yeah.
So he's not really taking it to the end and developing this view very well theoretically. But in the tradition where he comes from, the tradition of Augustinian theology, there might be all sorts of ways to develop this idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm somewhat sympathetic to some of these views. And interestingly enough, they combine or they connect quite well with some of the work that people in the last 20 years have done on free will, and especially in moral responsibility. So if we're operating inside this idea of free will light, the way that I framed it before has been that there's this there's reasonable action.
Mm-hmm.
So you're somehow in control of your actions by way of acting reasonably. But perhaps there's a way around this. So even if one thinks that this is not compatible with determinism, but there might be a way to do this. And this is something that Luther implies and some contemporary philosophers apply. They flesh it out in the following way. So the idea is like this. You can be held morally responsible for the kinds of actions that represent the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
The actions that represent your judgments, your attitudes, your beliefs, and your intentions. It doesn't matter whether those beliefs or intentions or any of other stuff is really up to you. So control over these things or control of action doesn't really matter. What matters is that the actions represent the way you are.
Okay.
And there's many ways of doing this, but Luther is kind of implying this. Sometimes this idea is known as the idea of ownership,
mm-hmm.
that you own your actions if those actions they kind of represent your attitudes. And then this is something that's compatible with determinism quite clearly. So you can be determined in all of your actions and all of your attitudes and judgment can be determined, but there can still be a relationship between those attitudes and those actions and those judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And this link is what provides ability for God and others to then judge morally, you know, make moral judgments about your moral character or take certain attitudes towards you. Because your actions and the way that you relate to other people and the way that you think about them are connected in this specific way.
Okay, so not everybody was happy with Luther, though, right? I mean, he got in a debate with Erasmus. Like, how would someone like Erasmus respond to some of these claims from Luther?
Well, Erasmus actually pretty much agrees with Luther in terms of the conditions
mm-hmm.
for free will.
Okay.
So he thinks that in order to have free will, one has to have some sort of control over one's choices and some sort of control over one's character. And well, Erasmus just thinks that we can get that. We do have that. And the way that he plays it is that we know that God holds us morally responsible
mm-hmm.
for our actions. So we know that God punishes evil and rewards the saints. This is something that we know. Well, God, and we also know that God is not unjust. So God is perfectly just and righteous. So if we know that God punishes and rewards people justly, if we know that, we also know that people have free will.
Okay.
So that's the way that he runs it. Because then he thinks, well, God would be unjust to punish people if they act in such a way that they don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or God is God is wrong to praise the saints if the saints has had nothing to do with the shaping of the right. character.
Yeah, yeah.
So if the sainthood of the saints is not really up to the saints, then it makes no sense for God to praise them and
right.
say, well, here are these good people and here are all these rewards.
Mm-hmm. Well done, good and faithful servant, that I determined you to be this way.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So from Erasmus, for Erasmus, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So because God rewards and punishes and God is just, it follows that people have free will. And this is exactly the reversal of how Luther does mm-hmm. it. So Luther wants to say that God holds people responsible, but at the same time, he says, well, people don't have free will. So it's not really up to the individuals to...
have control over their actions like that. Yeah.
But God still has the right to hold them responsible because they're still acting on the basis of their nature, so to speak. So when someone does an evil act, that's because they hate something or they have an attitude of distrust or unfaithfulness or whatever. So they're acting on the basis of the way that they are, and because they're evil, they make evil actions. They do evil actions. And it's okay for God to punish them, even though they can't control whether they're evil or not, just on the basis of the evil actions themselves, because the evil actions represent the way that they are.
Right.
So that's the reasoning behind it.
Okay, so that's a really interesting debate. I think it highlights something that I find kind of fascinating here that I want to get into. So it seems like people, they think freedom plays a major role in our theological debates, and people get really animated about whether or not we have free will. So, but I guess I'm kind of curious, why do people think free will is so important? Like, why do they think it matters? And you've done some work on cognitive science, and so I'm kind of curious if there's any insights from cognitive science that tells us about, you know, why we think free will matters so much to us.
Well, in the theological context, free will comes up in many different contexts. And moral responsibility is the biggest one, but it connects to all sorts of different theological doctrines. And as Erasmus points out, it's kind of weird to say that, well, you human beings are sinful, but there's really nothing you can do to avoid committing sins. And then say, well, God actually punishes you from those sins. For Erasmus, that seems weird.
Yeah.
So, because how could God punish you for things that you can't really avoid? There's nothing you can do to avoid sin. And then God would then, on top of this kind of major bad thing in the world, God would put another one, which is punishment.
Right.
Say, and that seems unjust. And as a consequence, Erasmus is committed to the idea that, yes, there is original sin, and yes, there is sin in the world, and you're sinful. But there's some measure of control over your actions that you still have, because otherwise you couldn't be held responsible for that. Otherwise you'd just be a victim of sin. But in order for God to be able to punish you, you really have to be the agent of sin too, in some rather robust way. So in that sense, in terms of sin, then in terms of grace. So the reason why the reformers talked so much about free will was this issue of grace and whether God... basically the relationship between God's giving of grace and free will. And of course Erasmus thought that like Luther, that grace is a gift, so God gives this gift of grace, but at some point in the process there has to be something that the individual does that is not determined or necessitated by God, because otherwise then the person is not, let's say, cooperating or taking part into this process of grace, and then the person cannot be blamed or punished or anything like that, again held responsible for this. Of course Luther completely denies this.
Sure.
He says that in no point the human can do anything to earn grace or keep himself or herself in grace. So it's purely, and from the beginning to the end, an act of God. But Erasmus says that no, this can't be, because otherwise it gets into all sorts of trouble. So the individual is not responsible, it's not taking part in this. So these are, I guess, one of the reasons why people have had kind of theological interest in figuring out exactly how free will works.
So that's kind of what's going on with why people get so animated about these different debates over free will in theological circles.
Yeah, that's the cognitive science bit.
Yeah, but so cognitive science, though, what does cognitive science have to say about some of this?
One of the interesting aspects of the debate between Erasmus and Luther on this thing is that on free will and moral responsibility was that in the beginning of his own book on the issue, Erasmus says that Luther's view on people not having any kind of free will, that might have unwanted political and moral consequences. Because if you tell people that they don't have free will, then they take that as a free pass to do whatever they want.
Sure, yeah.
And of course this is something that Luther rejects. He puts this aside. But there is some interesting evidence. There's some interesting work that has been done in the cognitive sciences in the last 10-15 years or so, where people have studied the kinds of ways that belief in free will makes a difference in terms of people's behaviors. So in other words, what people have tried to study are situations in which people's views on free will, on belief, the belief in free will is somehow shaken or somehow undermined or something like that. And then you see whether there's a behavioral difference. And it turns out that that believing in free will, believing in the possibility of making a difference, believing that what you intend and so on make a difference in terms of the world and make a difference in terms of what happens.
Okay.
That this has a big impact on people's behaviors. And there are a number of studies done on this. Social psychologist Roy Baumeister is one who's been organizing a lot of this work. There are many others as well. But they made a number of interesting findings. The general idea is that belief in free will seems to correlate with pro-social behavior.
Okay.
So the more you believe in free will or the less you believe in free will, that makes a difference in terms of how pro-social you are towards others. So if your belief in free will is shaken or undermined, you tend to cheat more. so they've done all sorts of economic experiments, and people tend to cheat when their belief in free will is undermined. All sorts of other effects have been found. People tend to stick with the status quo of a social situation the more they disbelieve in free will. So it takes some sort of it's kind of easy to understand why that might be. So in order for you to change the social situation, you have to believe that whatever you do kind of makes a difference in terms of that situation.
Right.
So if you think that you don't have free will, it gives you the impression that there's nothing you can do to change the circumstances. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nothing I do matters. It doesn't make an impact. So why bother?
And as a consequence, then people kind of challenge, make challenging choices. Mm-hmm. Don't make challenging choices, or don't commit themselves to courses of action that might lead them to the situations where they're socially sanctioned or things like that. And then there are a number of other interesting findings, including a finding that has to do with, let's say, the existential aspect of life. So it seems that if you undermine a person's confidence in the existence of free will, they experience their lives as less meaningful.
Mm.
So again, it's easy to see how this might come about. So in order for you to experience your life meaningful, you have to have a sense of being able to shape your own life or mm-hmm. shape your own future. But if your belief in free will is shaken or undermined, then it seems that there's really nothing you can do, or at least it's less probable that you're able to shape your life or your future, and that gives you a sense of less meaning in life. So if you put all these results together, the kind of picture that it paints is that this belief in the possibility of making a difference is actually quite important for human moral motivation. So we need this belief to be able to make a difference, to be able to have our choices and our intentions and our goals to shape the world in order to act morally mm-hmm. and meaningfully in this world. There might be all sorts of ways around this, but this is intuitively very plausible. So it seems to me that some of these practical worries that Erasmus raises against Luther are quite justified on the basis of the evidence that we have now.
Okay, so Erasmus makes these various claims, and it seems like the cognitive science is actually backing it up to some extent against Luther.
Yeah, I guess that's what it looked like. Mm-hmm. But of course, one has to remember that what we're talking about here is just belief,
right?
Free will.
It doesn't actually say we have free will.
No, it doesn't say anything like that.
Yeah.
It just says that it's beneficial for our moral behavior. It might not be necessary for our moral motivations, mm-hmm. But it plays an important role in the way that we intuitively think about our agency mm-hmm. in this world. And of course, it might still be the case that we don't have free will.
Right.
But this is there might be a kind of practical or pragmatic argument that one could launch on the basis of these results. And it would go something like this. So first of all, we don't know whether mm-hmm. determinism is true.
Right.
So there are some reasons to think that it is, and there are some reasons to think that it's not true. Okay, so let's be agnostic about that.
Okay.
So we don't know whether determinism is true. But this idea of free will, an idea for free will is because of these reasons that I just put forward.
From all the cognitive science.
Yeah,
right.
From all cognitive science and from other reasons as well. It's rather important for us. It's really good that we believe in free will.
Mm-hmm.
And you could even say that it's good that we believe in something like free will light. Free will regular or even free will premium.
Uh-huh.
This provides us with certain practical benefits.
Right.
So we don't know whether determinism is true, and it's really good for us that we do have this belief. Let's do a Pascal's wager.
Okay, yeah.
Let's do a kind of Pascal's wager. So if it turns out that we don't have free will, and we believed and acted as if we had free will anyway, well, we would have gotten all these good things as benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it turns out that...
you don't actually have any free will, no big deal, because you still get the benefits, right?
Yes. So in that sense, one could launch a practical argument in saying that that perhaps it would make sense for us to behave as if we had free will premium or free will regular.
Yeah.
And even if we didn't.
Right.
So, but that requires a certain level of gnosticism about whether determinism is true or not.
Yeah.
But that would be a kind of safe bet.
A safe bet. So, yeah. So it turns out I do have free will. Well, cool. I did some really awesome things that developed my character, helped other people out, benefited society. Turns out I don't have free will. Well, I still did some really awesome stuff, so no big deal. Okay. Well, that's really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for clarifying these issues. So Aku, this is the popcorn round where guests don't know the questions ahead of time. The questions can be random and the answer is more ridiculous. You have to answer these questions as quickly as possible, faster than one can say pop pop.
Okay, well I'm pretty slow, so
okay.
Let's see how it goes.
We'll see how this goes. Alright, so question number one. What is the most stereotypical Finnish thing that you do?
Self-deprecate.
This makes me so happy. Okay, because I was guessing you would say this. So last year at the Helsinki Analytic Theology Conference, Tim Paul and I were trying to make a bet to see how many compliments can we give Aku, and will he keep just doing something self-deprecating? And remember this moment where there's your book on on free will, that's really cool. I was like, I really loved your book on naturalism, and you just kept saying I guess, but it's a really terrible book, and it's not. You just kept saying these deprecating things, and Tim and I just kept looking at each other how far is he going to go with this?
So this is not just a feature of myself, although I've met people who've said that I excel at it.
Because you're very Finnish, right?
That's right. But Finns in general, this is a very Finnish thing. So Finns are not very good at kind of receiving compliments, because they feel somehow that if they accept the compliment, that they're somehow elevating themselves over some sort of imaginary line.
Yeah.
That you're not supposed to say that's a pretty good book or really good book or something like that.
Yeah. No,
the other person can say that and you can think that, but you can't say it.
You can't say that. That's awesome. Okay, so question number two. So imagine someone said to you, "Peace up, A-Town down." How would you respond?
I don't know what that means.
Oh gosh, okay. This is the beginning of Usher's Yeah song.
Yeah.
Did you? Yeah. Mm, okay.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, it's okay. It's fair.
That happened to me 10 years ago when I was in the US, and I said something, and another person started to laugh, and then he held up his fist right at my face.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do.
Oh, good, because that would have been when fist bumps were released.
Yes,
yeah.
I did not know
okay.
how to react.
So, yeah, in that case, then, you would have left him hanging, which was not... That's a massive faux pas at that
yes,
point.
Yes, yeah, I know. I just said that I don't know what to do when you do
right.
that.
I was teaching high school when that first became a thing, and I remember one student held up his fist to the kid next to him, and the guy next to him was like, I'm not going to fist bump you, I refuse to do this, and then they look at me like, are you going to keep teaching? And I was like, well, you can't leave a brother hanging like that. You have to. I mean, I can't keep teaching until you fist bump him. Come on. And he was so aggravated, and everybody in the class put all this pressure on him to finally just go ahead and fist bump. And then I was able to go okay, now I can carry on with my lecture. So,
But this lack of knowledge about this practice of fist bumping is actually a good example of this free will issue.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not fist bumping you because I don't know what it is, It means that my lack of fist bumping is not an expression of my judgment about you or an attitude that I have towards you or something like that. So in that sense, that the omission of not bumping,
mm-hmm.
The omission of bumping, that doesn't represent my the way that I am,
mm-hmm.
which would then say that, well, I shouldn't be held responsible for
right.
that action.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be blamed for not bumping,
mm-hmm.
or said that, well, Aku actually doesn't like you because he doesn't fist bump you. So that's a good example of free will.
All right. So question number three. When was the last time you made an electronica album?
It depends on how long.
Mm.
So how you define an album.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure.
If you just say a song,
yeah.
Then that's a couple of days.
Okay.
But if it's an album, then it's a couple of years.
Okay. So you're still working on different songs and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
So I'm making music all the time.
Do you post it anywhere?
Trying.
At least trying to make it, yeah. Do you post it anywhere online? I can't remember.
Sometimes. I've got some stuff on SoundCloud,
mm-hmm.
and some other places, but I haven't added any new stuff in a long time. I've finished some new stuff, but I've been hesitant to put it online.
All right, fair enough. So question number four. When you received your PhD, did you get a sword?
Unfortunately, not. I did not get a sword. This is a curiosity of the University of Helsinki. So when you do a PhD, when you're conferred a PhD status, what you do get is a sword. But the theologians are an exception. So the theologians only get a Bible.
Okay.
So the others get this cool sword, and us theologians just get a crummy Bible. And we've got Bibles already.
Right.
So it's a bit of a disappointment. Of mm-hmm. course, there's a lot of symbolism there. It's the
sword of God and
sword
stuff.
Of
yeah.
The God and sword of God and things like that. But it was a letdown.
Yeah, I would imagine because if I got to that point, I'd be like, I've already got several Bibles. And
yes.
What am I supposed to do with this?
Yes, but you definitely usually don't have swords.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in undergrad, I remember I received a Bible that a bunch of professors had signed, and so at least that had some kind of sentimental value to me, but I would have wanted a sword, you know, if I had the option.
Yeah.
But they're not going to give out swords in America to students who are graduating.
It is a special Bible that you get. There are a number of special pages with Latin on them.
Okay, like, that's nice.
That here are the professors and the deans, and then they conferred to you this the status of having a PhD from here and things like that, and it's in cool Latin, but it's still the same Bible.
Still the same Bible.
Yeah.
All right, so question number five. So say you've been given an elephant. You cannot get rid of the elephant. What do you do with it?
That's a difficult question. I probably wouldn't eat the elephant.
Okay.
But I come from the countryside, from a farm. So we have plenty of space. So we could probably house the elephant.
Okay.
And have it live in the farm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I guess that's... Yeah, because I know there a lot of places in Finland, nobody's living there. So you've got a lot of space.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then one just needs a barn,
mm-hmm.
running a barn for an elephant.
Yeah.
The problem might be the cold.
Uh-huh.
So the winter might not be a very suitable place for the elephant. But we can keep cows warm mm-hmm. during the winter, so why not elephants too?
Mm-hmm. Just make a sauna big enough for the elephant, I guess. I mean.
Yeah, or make a big barn
mm-hmm.
that stays warm over the winter, and shouldn't be too difficult.
Okay.
I'd probably keep the elephant.
Keep the elephant around. There we go. Okay, so final question. What was the last song or artist that you listened to?
That must have been James Newton Howard, who's a film composer, and I was listening to his soundtrack to new Terrence Malick film, I think it's called A Hidden Life.
Okay.
Just came out about this guy who, in Austria during the Second World War,
mm.
and the Nazis tried to recruit him, but he doesn't want to become a Nazi. It's a true story based on a guy called Franz Jägerstätter. And this movie is... I haven't seen the movie, but I was listening to the soundtrack, and it was quite nice.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for episodes on Aseity, the Trinity, and so much more.